We're going to discuss the parable of the unjust steward. The topic, let's see, what did I dub it as? A scoundrel? What was the subtopic?
Smooth operator.
Okay, there we go. A smooth operator. We're in chapter 16 of Luke. And I'm John Ligory, for those who haven't been here before. I keep mentioning this because a few people are new, but this is the book in the bookstore by Danker, D-A-N-K-E-R, that will provide some help as to themes in Luke. It's not a commentary. Pardon? Oh, it's not a commentary in the traditional sense, but it is helpful pointing out some of the themes. And I hope I've been pointing to some of them as we go along also. Although it's very hard in a setting like this to do anything in a comprehensive way, because as Laurie Rasmussen pointed out, each unit has to be able to stand alone because there are different people coming in and out. And so it's difficult to try to show a real, you know, systematic progression of Luke's thought. Although this week, as you know, we've been working with parables. We'll have hit a total of 6 or 7 this week, and next week I'll be jumping around to some different types of texts in the Gospel, and we'll touch on Acts at least in one of those texts. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. I've got a handout. I sometimes feel guilty I don't refer enough to the handout. But it just gives you an idea of the way that different texts can be set up in terms of literary structure. And if you just take one and pass it around, please. Okay, now, one of the questions we're going to discuss is whether this parable ends at verse 8 or verse 9. I'll express a little bias then by asking someone to read chapter 16, verses 1 through 8, instead of to where the paragraph actually ends, at least in the RSV rendering of things. Would someone turn to Luke 16 and read nice and loudly verses 1 through 8?
And he also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a steward, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Turn in the account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward.' And the steward said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the stewardship away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that people may receive me into their houses when I am put out of the stewardship.' So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest steward for his prudence, for the sons of this world are wiser in their own generation than the sons of light.'"
Thank you. This parable is agreed by many, many New Testament scholars as being the very toughest one in the whole New Testament. And so I just want to point this out before we get started, that this may be a very troubling one for you, and you may feel very uneasy when we're done with this hour, because there are many ways of interpreting this, and there's great disagreement as to what's really going on here between the steward and the master, what the cultural circumstances here, the economic realities of the situation are. And also, of course, what is the theme? What is Luke getting at? What is Jesus getting at here? So this is a very tough parable, and so we're going to have to wade through it with that in mind, that we may not be too satisfied when we're done discussing it. Okay? let's just look at that sheet I handed out and just point out, like the other parables, we can speak in terms of some stanzas. You have on the sheet you see an A and an A prime, a B prime, well, two B's and two B primes, and then a C. So you see that the theme that is that you see over on the right side with A, for example, rich man, steward, a rascal, or a scoundrel, or a smooth operator, is in a sense carried over in A prime at the end. B, the two B's and the two B primes kind of go together, and C kind of stands more by itself. Now another way to look at that is this. You've got a rich man steward in A. In the first B, you've got a problem addressed. In the second B, you have a problem also addressed. In C, you have an idea. You see the light bulb turning on. Aha! Guess what I'm going to do. And then in B prime, you have a solution. Second B prime, additional ramification or application of the solution. And on A prime at the end, again, the rich man, the steward. So that's kind of the flow of things from a literary standpoint in this particular parable. Now the context here is a series of parables. As you who were here yesterday recall, in chapter 15, there are essentially three parables. We dealt yesterday with the sheep and the lost coin. The first two, we did not talk about the prodigal son, which of course could be a weak study in itself. In chapter 16, we have more parables. We have this one starting out the chapter. Tomorrow we will take one that immediately follows this, but is quite different in many respects, I think, and we'll go through that in some detail. And then we have the rich man and Lazarus, starting in verse 19, which we're going to take up on Saturday. And the themes, I feel, are very different in these three, and they're, you know, they just happen to be in the same chapter, but I think you will find, too, that they are very different. We could just well be hopping around chapters, in a sense, as far as what seems to be said in these parables. Okay, now, play my usual trick and turn the board over. I have to use kind of a problem-solving approach. My throat's kind of bad. I'm sorry, I played volleyball without my... Is it better back here? That's fine, okay. Here are some of the problems we want to talk through and try to analyze and agree or disagree upon together. Does this parable end with verse 8 or verse 9? What are some indications of one or the other? Who is the master in verse 8? Is it Jesus or is it the owner? Is the master an honorable person? Is the steward honorable? It's called the parable of the unjust steward. Is the steward unjust? How unjust? A scoundrel? 5. Are worldly people wiser than the sons of light? This is in verse 8. Is that what it's saying? They're wiser, more prudent than the sons of light. Who are the sons of light? 6. Should disciples gain friends and security by means of money? Now this seems to be the message, doesn't it, as you read it? Through the first time, Jesus says, here's what happened, and the disciples have been addressed. It worked out pretty well, disciples. Why don't you use this as a basis for your mode of operating also? Is that what Jesus is saying? Okay, those are just some of the questions we're going to discuss.
Do we know why the rich man dismissed him in the first place?
Well, let's discuss that, because that bears on the question of, is the rich man honorable in the way he handled the situation?
He was wasting the master's goods.
Okay. He had proof, supposedly, from other sources. right? Mm-hmm. What does he say? I hear that. Mm-hmm. What is this that I hear about you?
Charges were brought.
He's gotten information from other sources. Now, how about any of you who have people who work, who you supervise in any, or who you have in any circumstance, and there have been reasons for you to feel that the people working under you are not doing their job, or they are, whatever they're doing is not pleasing you. How would you approach the situation like this rich man did? Depends on the, for one thing, on the value, the types of sources that you have, right? How reliable you feel they are based on previous experience.
Well, is the expression charges were brought to the master about this, that the man was wasting, is that more formal than just, you know, idle rumor? It was, charges sounds kind of, you know,
formal
and documented to me. Not as though somebody just said, boy, you better look at that steward.
Well, what do you feel, anybody? In view of what happens later in the parable, how formal do you think the charges might be?
Well, from what went on afterwards, we have reason to believe that probably were justified.
In the Good News, it says that he was told that the manager was wasting his master's money. It doesn't say charges. So.
Uh-huh. And the Gideon says accused.
Yeah.
Gideon,
yeah.
Not one.
Which would be
so
like charges.
It depends a lot, I think, what was in the original tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what was there.
Well, if the master in verse 8 is, say, the rich man, rather than Jesus addressing the point, it seems that the rich man certainly has the authority or whatever to dismiss the accusations or to not hold them against them. In other words, that they have not been filed in a court someplace and that they are out of his hands, and therefore that would be one thing suggesting that the charges are not that formal, or that the rich man really is lord of his whole operation.
Which was probably the case.
What bothers me about the rich man's approach is that, two things. One, the steward does not defend himself, at least in this parable, right? Silence suggests guilt in this case. But what bothers me is that the master did not ask the steward, are these charges correct? I mean, would you do this for somebody that you were supervising in an office?
He asks the question and then immediately gives the decision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's already made up his mind before he... Of course, maybe he doesn't like
maybe
to deal with...
Maybe evidence himself, though.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel the master is an honorable person?
Oh, it's sort of like that initial part is kind of telescoped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I guess when I wrestled with trying to make some sense out of this parable, that part seems telescoped to me. And since there is, most of the story has to do with how the steward handled his dilemma, I guess I figured that's probably where the essence is supposed to be perceived.
Well, telescoping, or even if you want to say abbreviation, is a tendency that Luke has in his gospel. You may not think that to be the case. For example, yesterday when we looked at the parable of the sheep, the lost sheep, we compared it with Matthew's account, which is much briefer than Luke's. So you tend to think if anybody's doing the expanding, it's Luke. But on the other hand, even with the more full-blown version that Luke gives, we don't know what happened to those 99 sheep, how they got back. And so here again, there may have been a lot more going on, but and Luke may have had access to a much fuller-blown account of this parable too, but chose for one reason or another to compress it as much as he could, telescope, but are abbreviated.
I'd like to suggest maybe a setting that might help a little bit. In the first verse, he says there was a certain man who had a steward, and this steward, in other words, the man could have been a businessman who had many men underneath him, mm-hmm. rather than only one certain overseer over all of his work. Mm-hmm. And then he says, give an account of your stewardship, and then that's what the steward is doing after that. Perhaps the master is testing the steward to see whether he really is honest, to see whether these charges are substantiated. And he says, okay, go fix up your accounts and bring them in to me. And what does the steward go do? He goes out and he arranges the things so that he'll come out well, because he just kind of takes it as a foregone conclusion that his job is gone. Right? And then he says, well, the master goes on to say, give an account of your stewardship. That's kind of like a testing thing, for you can no longer be a steward. Again, putting a little bit of pressure on the fellow to see how he'll react to that situation, whether he'll react in a way of integrity or whether he'll react in a way that's self-serving.
Well, the phrase, give an account of your stewardship, can be viewed, if you read the Greek, as an expression of turn in your account books. You know, the records you've been keeping, I want them now. You're done, through, finished. And rather than saying, I've heard these things, and, you know, by this weekend I expect you to be off in some other occupation, hired by somebody else, just gone. So it can be viewed as, either way, as the master giving him some time to show what stuff he's really made of, or being a very strict, get out, I've had enough. Which tends to be more the way overseers operated in those days. That is, you didn't have to give 2-week notice to anybody. See, I've got enough evidence, and this is it. I'm master of my operation, and I feel there's enough evidence that you should be moving on. And so go back to your office or wherever you have, you know, maybe various places where he has his accounts, the bookkeeping and so on, but get them together, bring them in, turn them in, you're through. Okay, maybe not okay. What kind of a relationship is there? I mean, what is the steward of, and what is the circumstance?
Well, I wonder, before we get off that rich man, notice the verse 19, it begins the same way, there was a rich man. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this doesn't relate to the Old Testament wisdom idea expressed, for example, in Psalm 73, where the people of this generation, of this age, get along very well, but the end result is their condemnation. So that we have a man getting along very well with a rich man and so on, even though he's dishonest and so on. But in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, you see the ultimate condemnation.
Mm-hmm.
So I may admire the mafia and its operation. I think they're very, not only clever, but they're very wealthy and they know how to avoid the law and so on. But maybe their condemnation will come.
Yeah, there is.
You won't see it.
Yeah, there is this very common theme in Luke of a reversal of fortunes.
Uh-huh.
You know, he who humbles himself will be exalted, and so on. And the rich man goes to Hades, Lazarus goes to heaven. Yeah. And this is a very common theme, a reversal of fortunes. So, yes, that does impact here, I think, upon any time you see a rich man. The down and outers compared with the fat cats is something that Luke really likes to play on a lot. What relationship do you think is going on here? I mean, the steward is steward of what? What is the economic, what is the operating, the way of operating, do you think, between the steward and the rich man? I mean, how is the rich man a money lender, do you think, and the steward a person who helps, collect the money that has been lent?
Well, he's dealing in products. Isn't he produce of some kind, measures of oil?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that would suggest land or sharecropping or some such notion, perhaps.
He's a merchant.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is this is what gets very complicated when one is trying to decide what the relationship is, because, okay, is it a merchant, and this steward is in charge of checking the storehouses to see how the deliveries are coming in, and that the steward then will tack on a surcharge, for example, that will be what the steward kind of skims off the top for his own personal use, you see, knowing that there's a basic charge or percentage that he has to make sure the master gets back. Well, the question would come in terms of when the steward does reduce the debts of these, let's say they are renters, or let's say they are renting property, for example. And they,
would the master still get his due amount?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Because what is the relationship between the master's base to keep the operation going, what the steward gets, and what the renters, let's say, have to pay? Is the steward charging a fair amount in the first place? Does the master know how much the renters are paying the steward?
For all we know, the 50 and the 80 was really all he owed. Is this what you're suggesting, or asking?
Yeah, mm-hmm. All he owed, you mean the renter?
All the renter owed, legally owed the rich man.
Well, let's suggest that there is property involved here, and there are people that rent the property and grow wheat and soybeans and other things. And let's assume that there is a set amount that the steward has to make sure that the master gets back for each acre or something rendered. Let's assume that the steward is on a fixed income as far as the master, that is, a salary basis from the master, 12-month salary. The question then arises, is there a certain margin of profit or an extra surcharge, you see, that the master expects the steward to charge? I mean, is there an income plus, sharing in the dividends, or charging whatever the market will bear, and compared with some other master down the road? In those days, it was fairly common for this to be the arrangement, that is, for the rich man, the master, to hire stewards on a salaried basis. And that then, beyond that, the steward would charge a certain amount more. That would be, it'd be like waitressing, maybe you could say, where you are paid a very, very minimum wage, and then you are expected to get a rough amount of tips over and beyond that. This is very possibly the kind of arrangement they had. And besides that, depending on the relationship between the steward and the renters, the renters may have kind of given the steward a little money on the side to do favors, so that whatever land they were renting got, if they needed machinery or something, they had a little more priority over somebody else who was renting some land. There might have been a lot of little things going on the side that we don't understand here. But then, as Adam was suggesting, if the steward then comes to the renter and says, here, take your bill and reduce it from 100 down to 50 or 100 down to 80, that reduction may then have represented the steward's tips, or the percentage based on that commodity that the steward was expected to be able to keep for his own livelihood.
So in that respect, even in what appears to us to be some kind of a scam, he wasn't cheating his master. He was absorbing that loss in order to gain friends.
If that's what you understand the relationship to be, yes, that would be a logical conclusion. If you conclude that, would you feel that the steward is an unjust person, a scoundrel, a smooth operator? Not that those terms are necessarily synonymous.
I'm sure he's a smooth operator.
Might is also trying to regain favor with the manager or rich man. So that covers up whatever sloppy dealings he had.
Was he trying to regain favor with the master as much as he was with the rest of the people? You know, this would imply that it was the master, wouldn't it? But earlier, he didn't say that. He was going to assure himself, yeah.
Feather his nest
with his friend, or with the renters.
Do you want to respond to that? Do you think he's trying to find, you know, get himself ingratiated with both the master and the renters?
Yes, he's pretty sharp operator.
Yeah. He wanted to be able to play both sides. I think.
Back
but
there.
If this were the tips, the master wouldn't be seeing that money anyway. So he's not necessarily, is he ingratiating himself with the master by doing so? Because that's nothing that he has to gain or lose by anyway.
Well, after the master has dropped the bombshell that I've got these charges or these feelings or whatever, that you are not doing what I want you to do, what is the steward's response? I mean, does he feel that there's a chance of restoring his relationship with the master?
But I mean, if that 50 measures of oil or whatever was going to be the steward's portion anyway, the master doesn't. Whether he writes it off for himself, it's nothing for the master. So the master doesn't gain either way.
Mm-hmm.
And but so the way it's written, in the way it, my impression is that that was really owed to the master. Mm-hmm. And that's the way he's ingratiated, because especially if the people that were paying this perceived it as just going to them, they would immediately see that he's just not taking any profit right now or something.
Well, I was just going to say, I saw it that even if that's the 50 and the 80 that's owed the master, and the master gets it, and he thinks that's all he's supposed to get anyhow, I would think that the steward would be ingratiating himself with him. And at the same time, with the others, because they'd be thinking, well, now isn't he a good guy? He isn't taking his cut.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be my impression. He was trying to get.
The steward could well be taking a risk. I mean, we don't know what relationship the steward and the master have had. And maybe the master is a real smooth operator himself, and that he wants to make sure that the total amount on a bill by one of these renters is comparable to what it is over on the next, you know, rich man's estate too, so that everybody keeps about the same. I mean, if all of a sudden the bill starts being slashed by quite a bit on your own property, well, you're going to want a lot more renters. You're going to want to rent your property, for one thing. What is the time element here? I mean, what do the renters know anything of what has transpired between the master and the steward? But you get the feeling that everything's kind of frantic here.
Mm-hmm.
The bombshell's been dropped. He's got to get these books and turn them in to the master, but before he does that, the light bulb turns on. He has an idea. I've got to secure my future some way. And bingo, he goes right out to these renters, and by reducing their debt, the renters may well react by thinking that, wow, what a fine master we have. Huh? All of a sudden, there's a discount. So, in a way, the steward is really complimenting or raising the level of appreciation by the renters of the master, because for all they know, now the rich man is so rich that he finally has decided maybe he's been converted, or whatever. He's gone to a tent meeting, and he all of a sudden has decided that, gee, I don't need to make that much money, let's cut back a little bit. And so the steward does accomplish that very probably in the minds of the renters. Or do you feel otherwise?
Not if they understood that as a extra portion that would just go to the steward anyway. They didn't know about that operating procedure, I would guess.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when he asks them to do it, he says, take it and write down quickly, you know, you only own so much. So it seems like they're doctoring the books right there as far as maybe the way the accounts are being held that way. And when he talks about why he's doing it there, and then where at first he says, so that when I am removed from the stewardship, they will receive me into their homes. Not really thinking about the master's giving all, but just kind of feathering his own nest, as they said.
As a consumer yourself, you know, as one of the renters, so put your position, make yourself feel like one of the renters. Used to paying maybe over a period of years a certain amount for, you have an idea of inflation and so on, and machinery and other overhead costs and so on. And if a furniture store down the street all of a sudden has a real hot special on some furniture, is it really hot stuff that's come in through the mafia? I mean, you've all heard about these situations where there's material, stereos or whatever, available for really drastic prices. Aren't you rather suspicious now? You're kind of wondering about your own honor, too, in going out and purchasing something like that. So the renters may have had some thoughts but like that. But certainly one of them may have been, if the sequence of events is as swift as the parable suggests, that the master's really a good guy and glad he's my master and not this other guy down the road. I guess we'll jump down a ways. Let me just mention a couple of items of number 1 and 2. Verses 8 and 9, where does the parable end? Now, the reason that some feel that the parable ends at verse 8 is because of the phrase that starts verse 9, the phrase, "and I tell you." Remember when we were in chapter 11, we were discussing when one parable ends and the other begins? It was precisely that same phrase that comes in, which Luke uses as a way, as I mentioned then, possibly of changing the audience to which he is directing his comments.
So is it really the moral of the story that they're clinching?
Could be. Now, this comes into the second question. Is the master in verse 8 Jesus, or is it the rich man? Now, my feeling, I think the natural feeling is that it's the rich man. Because the Greek word kurios, which I think many of you have heard, is used in, I think verses 3 and 5 also. The same word is used. I mean, Luke has a tendency to use that word, kurios, only for Jesus or God, which is one suggestion that verse 8, maybe God, possibly, or I mean Jesus. Another reason is that, as you've been seeing from the parables we've already discussed this week, that Luke has a tendency at the end of a parable to then put a statement in the mouth of Jesus as saying what this means. Toward the end of a parable, just like at the end of a miracle, you might always often get the feeling that Jesus is saying, now here is what it means. Be another reason to tend to suspect that Master might be, you know, here's the situation, now here's what it means. So Master could refer to Jesus. But I think, because of these other things I mentioned, that here the weight of the evidence would be on saying that the Master in verse 8 is the rich man, not Jesus.
But doesn't Jesus say somewhere, except ye be as cunning as foxes, which indicates you need to know how to play it cool if you're going to be effective in this world? I don't know where that comes in the New Testament, but I've always thought that was a nice piece of advice when I was cunning as foxes.
Why is it serpent?
That's right. It always surprises me that Jesus says this. This is one of our weapons.
Yeah.
If we're ever going to make it,
yeah.
We've got to be like this, and that would be the same tone.
Isn't that the way he always treated the Pharisees?
And Jesus commended the unjust steward.
Yeah.
The children of this world are wiser than the children of light. But there seemed to be a commendation there, doesn't there?
Okay, let's move to that, because this is the fifth question here that I've written down. I think the versions will vary here in verse 8 a bit. The RSV is
more shrewd.
The sons of this world are wiser, is the RSV, in their own generation than the sons of light. Now, you have more shrewd
in
yours?
RSV too.
Okay.
It's King James has the other.
What else do you have? What are the other renderings here? Anybody have something different? How about good news?
Shrewdness.
Shrewdness? Mm-hmm.
Who had a prudence? Somebody had a
good news.
What did that say?
Who's got the good news?
Which verse is that in?
Eight. The second half of the verse.
That the master of this dishonest manager praised him for doing such a shrewd thing. Whereas the people of this world are much more shrewd in their handling of affairs than the people who belong to the light.
People who belong to the light? Uh-huh. Okay. The sons of this world and the sons of light are the contrast now. Okay, so who do you assume each is? Or who are the sons of this world, who are the sons of light? Are we into what we had yesterday? That is the righteous persons on the one hand and the repentant sinners on the other?
Yeah.
Or who do we have here? Who are the contrasts? In verse 9, if you kind of cheat and move ahead, you have the phrase unrighteous mammon in the RSV. One possibility is to say that the sons of this world or the unrighteous mammon are like worldly possessions or people who are preoccupied with material things, which does or does not mean you're a Christian, of course. Or need not mean you are or are not a Christian.
Is it, well, could it imply that your confidence is in possessions and making it on my own.
And those,
I take care of my own life.
Yeah.
Without trust in God.
And those thoughts
determine
your value system more than coming from a different direction. Is that people's feelings here, that the sons of this world therefore would be those who are preoccupied with material possessions, that the sons of light would be the Christians who, you know, take following Jesus as their cue for all their methods of operating?
That's what it means to me. I don't know.
Okay. And if it says that, doesn't it mean that, I mean, Jesus is addressing this to his disciples, right? If verse 8 is the punchline, isn't he telling his disciples, get a little more shrewd, wise up, and isn't that very contradictory to what he said?
Yeah.
Leave everything and follow me.
I don't think he's not commending the unjust or dishonest steward for being dishonest. He is simply commending him for his prudence, which maybe is a different matter. Oh, you can be prudent and be dishonestly prudent. Or you can be prudent and be honest.
Mm-hmm.
He could have gone out trying to get the whole amount from each of these people, too. Mm-hmm. Trying to get his share. And by giving that up, at least he hopefully made some friends, plus at least got the master his part without doing anything.
And
he gave up something to at least make things good in one side.
In a sense, this steward is consistent. If his confidence was in what he could do for himself, then apparently he didn't trust the master to have any particular mercy on him. He just accepted the situation and kept on trying to do for himself. And that's at least a kind of integrity. it's a consistent life. And I think maybe there is some implication of consistency then. If you choose to do it yourself, at least do it yourself well. If you choose to put your trust in Jesus, do that then consistently. And don't straddle the fence.
Are those less poles apart, those two options, than, say, sons of this world and sons of light? Do you think that Jesus is trying to set more absolute perimeters, and set the absolutes wider than the point he's really trying to make? In other words, you can be prudent and you can be dishonestly prudent.
Yeah.
To be prudent means more in the middle,
yeah.
Somewhere in the middle. Yeah. As we were discussing yesterday, between being unrighteous persons and being repentant sinners,
yeah.
Are they poles apart? Do you think Jesus is trying to show a big contrast between the types of people we are in order to come to some place in the middle? That is, we're all sinners. Some of us are less than others. And there are non-Christians who are much more ethical in their
yeah.
actions than
yeah.
many Christians.
I think it's important to recognize that Luke has Jesus saying these parables on the way to Jerusalem. It's as if he's preparing them to continue after his death. So to me it suggests adaptability. That he's encouraging them after he's gone to adapt to the circumstances of their lives.
Okay, this is a good point. I don't know, I think on about Tuesday I mentioned the literary structure of Luke, that starting in chapter 9 there's a long travel narrative which ends in chapter 19, in a sense. Some people will take it all the way to the end of the book, even. But that there's always the idea of setting his face toward Jerusalem. You see this in chapter 9, verse 51, I think.
Yeah.
When the days drew near for him to be received up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And you kind of have this feeling, you see, kind of, you know, accomplishing something, but and kind of stopping him all the way, but always moving, progressing toward a certain goal. And within this total mass of material of 10, 11 chapters, you have the feeling that the kingdom is coming. He is moving. Things are going to come to a climax. He is kind of revealing himself along the way. He's not being as hidden about his messiahship as Mark is. See, he reveals himself earlier in the game than does Mark. And the kingdom is coming, and he is bringing it in. We do not, as humans, bring in the kingdom, but we watch his progression toward Jerusalem. And that therefore, in this context, a parable with that in mind would suggest that the kingdom is coming, and you, as my followers, good followers, not so good followers, better be ready. This is a warning, is one possible theme here. It's an eschatological warning. The word eschatology means kind of the doctrine of the last things. But the way the idea of the future or a final accounting is portrayed in Luke as well as some others is that now is the time to prepare yourself for what is coming. Be prudent now about your matters. Because you don't know. The end will come like a thief in the night.
But Jesus was very shrewd too, wasn't he? For a long time, he didn't reveal himself, saying the time has not yet come. So he is in hiding. So when he tells us to be shrewd, I think he does it out of his character too. That this is a very cool person for a long time. Certainly Mark emphasizes this, but there might be other times when he escapes, you know, to go into the mountains and so on. But he is hidden along. A lot of the time.
Yeah, next week one of my intentions is to look at a number of texts that show the tension that exists, or that Luke is purposely trying to show in Jesus' thought, perhaps, between the need for immediate action and repenting now, and the idea that the future is quite a ways down the pike. There are a number of texts that show both sorts of things in Luke, and we're going to take a look at some of those next week. But this is definitely a possible theme here, that it's a warning that now, you know, think about the future and make provisions for yourself now. Certainly not only in relation to financial security, but also in terms, more importantly, in terms of the source of your hope.
Is that our interpretation of 9-1? I'm dying to get to that. When your time's going to run out, before you tell
us. Right, why don't you read that, Mola? Verse 9.
And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal habitations.
Okay, so that when it fails, it refers to material, you know, non-human sorts of entities in our life. So when it fails, they may receive you.
Who's they?
Doesn't the subject of the whole thing end up that we are the stewards of God? It means all of us. We are stewards of God's kingdom. And be prepared. Now, don't prepare for the future today. Be prepared today, not in the future. I think we're all stewards.
Yeah, I think
this is a
God theme.
Is our master.
I'm going to inject a theme here. Just that is the theme of God's mercy. The master was merciful. God is merciful. We know that, isn't it? The kind of God that we confess and pray to, a merciful God. But they're saying here, don't get too complacent about the kind of person that you confess your sins to, because you've got obligations. If you do point to God as the source of your salvation, you see, He is merciful forever and ever, but you are accountable. Professing that one as the source of your salvation means you are responsible to be stewards now, starting today. In your life, with whatever you have.
Never say tomorrow. Well, tomorrow never comes. Today is the day to be prepared.
And my feeling is that verse 9 is, in a sense, an application of the point made in verse 8. That in a way, one could come to that conclusion without verse 9. But that it helps it clarify it a little bit. Don't rely on material things so much. People matters are what really count in this life. Especially if your relationship to other people always takes its cue from your realization where the ultimate source of your salvation lies. Dwayne?
Who did they say they was? Or have we decided who they is? And I'm still uncomfortable with Jesus recommending anything unrighteous. You know, I still...
I don't think he's recommending.
I don't know, but he says, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous mammon.
Yeah, but
because I don't understand it yet, I'm finding that difficult to look at. And I'm still curious who they are.
Well, I don't have a pat answer, because this is one of the troubling things about this parable, is that what is the antecedent for the word yet? Is it unrighteous mammon, the antecedent? That is the material world. Is they the antecedent of they all good followers of Christ?
But, you know, there are so many other ways one could look at this too, and I shouldn't even inject this. But as I sat here thinking about this morning and the theme of Holden, you know, the problems that we're facing. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon. Doesn't necessarily imply that you go out and do the unrighteous, but maybe we as Christians need to really wise up to our need to move into the outside world. Wasn't this really Luke's message? It's the outside world, it's beyond the Jewish people that he was trying to reach. And you have a responsibility as a Christian. You can't just expect God to do it without your hands.
That's an excellent point. I think we have so often, as Christians, are thinking of the dualism between law and gospel within Lutheranism, that we've often felt that the law is there someplace, the world is there, that we have to kind of be monastic about our existence, and that we have to feel guilty about making a killing in the stock market or something. But Jesus
and
is
maybe
saying
if we
here,
were a lot shrewder than the mafia, they would never have gotten such a foothold.
Why the word unrighteous?
Well, branding mammon, that is wealth or something, as...
Is that what it, unrighteous means?
I think it's more the sense of potential for being, potential for evil. Wealth, material possessions have the potential for evil if they are misused, but they also have a great deal of potential for good. And the steward here was taking a real risk, wasn't he? I mean, he could have maybe gotten in worse trouble with the master with the risk that he was taking. Maybe he knew the circumstances that he didn't have anything to lose. And perhaps Jesus is saying to his disciples, be tuned in to with the value systems of these Pharisees and these sinners and these tax collectors around you. You know, be kind of shrewd about what they're, you know. You got to learn to speak their language in order to relate to them what is the source for your means of operating. And you got to take some risks. Relying all the time on that abundant source of mercy that is, you know, that is God. I was reading after our dance last night, Melinda. I was really fired up. worldly things. I felt I better pick up a book and call Life and Holiness. So I was up in Chalet number 9 with that beautiful view of the mountains. And this is by Thomas Merton. And in his conclusion to this, he had something to say about mercy that I thought would be appropriate to inject about this time. He says, the perfect Christian is therefore not one who is necessarily impeccable and beyond all moral weakness. Now, this is a Trappist monk speaking. Perfect Christian is not necessarily impeccable and beyond all moral weakness, but he is one who, because his eyes are enlightened to know the full dimensions of the mercy of Christ, is no longer troubled by the sorrows and frailties of his present life. His confidence in God is perfect, because he now knows, so to speak, by experience, that God cannot fail him. He responds to the mercy of God with perfect trust.